and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 549, and joining me today is Andrew Corse, and today we will be covering round one of World Superbike from Phillip Island. How's everything going today, Andrew?
Hey, really good. Really good to sit down and talk about racing, not just testing, not just about any of the old gossip trying to fill a show. This is actual racing. Really, really happy.
Yeah, for sure. We've gotten through the winter, and this is our first run at it. We still have to wait, another 3-4 weeks for another round, but it's definitely good to get that first taste.
Yeah, we have a little bit of news we're just going to cut through first. We have some MotoGP news, which, of course, there was a large item of a MotoGP news that broke just after we recorded and posted the last Motopod show. This definitely needs talking about, and this was the fact that Tech 3 announced that their some 20-year association with Yamaha as their Yamaha satellite team is coming to the end at the end of this 2018 MotoGP season. So the hot rumor has been who will the French team join? What manufacturer are they going to go with? And I think realistically, all the clever money is on KTM offering them. My guess is I think they've offered them at least 6 years with factory machinery. What do you think?
Yeah, I think all signs point to KTM. You look at Aprilia, they don't have a budget. Suzuki, in the past, I think they've said they have maybe budget to maybe one bike. So for a full two rider outfit, KTM really seems to be the only real choice. I know KTM had a 5 year they have a 5 year MotoGP project. So not sure how long the contract would be for, but, I really can't see it being with anyone else other than KTM.
I think it has to be a substantial chunk of time. I think, for Tech 3 to move away from Yamaha, Tech 3 always has been a little bit chafing at the bit. Yamaha is never going to give them full factory equivalents. I mean, there's no way a company like Movistar is going to pay a small fortune to be the title sponsor for the main team if there's any risk that Tech 3, with a smaller monster budget, can come and rival. And they've already almost been doing that with Zarcon, the 2016 bike that we've seen. So, we always knew that Harv Poncharal, the team manager at Tech 3, was never going to get the equivalence. It's something I think he'd sought. And I think this is something that KTM could offer him. They could say, look, we will give you factory machinery. And like I say, my guess is that for it to be worth considering, I think he's looking for 6 years. I think if most riders are on two-year contracts, that's sort of like three sets of two. And the other thing, too, is I think this allows KTM to potentially have, sign a deal with Zarco. We knew that Zarco was somebody that KTM were looking at as they've improved. They've got better. They realize, I think, now that they start to need a top flight rider to help keep their project moving forward. And this is a way, I think, for them to get Zarco on factory machinery.
For sure. And I think another big thing is it really builds a system for KTM all the way from Red Bull rookies to MotoGP. You know, they had a MotoGP factory team, but, there's only so many spots there. So this really gives an avenue for them to bring up Oliveira, bring up Binder, who apparently both have clauses in their contract to go straight to a MotoGP team. So this makes that transition for them even easier to grow that talent.
And hopefully as well, I think the development that they need to continue with the bike now, having four bikes running and the data and the feedback and the ability for different riders, different teams to try different parts as they try and close those few remaining tenths of the seconds to move to the head of the pack. This is another thing that I think they need and will help them.
For sure. And yeah, so it all makes sense. I think another thing that this presents is, will Yamaha have another satellite team? What other team possibly could come onto the grid? Could it be a VR 46 team, which seems to be really the only possibility as all the grid spots are accounted for until 2021. So there's definitely a lot of moving parts behind the scenes right now, which, I think really Rossi is going to dictate what happens with that team.
I think the difficulty is there's a lot of moving parts here, and there was no clear answers from the get-go. Dorna, we know, have said they only want to have 24 riders on the grid. They have financial commitments that they spend money with subsidizing transport, for example, for some of these teams. So they don't necessarily want more teams. So it sounded like between now and 2021, the only other way that Yamaha could have a satellite team would be essentially either buying another team or somehow renting a team's spots, I think, off of the grid for that period. It didn't sound like Sky VR46 are in a position to be able to move up, even by the end of this year into next year. So it's going to be interesting to see. I can't imagine a team wanting to take on Yamaha satellite bikes thinking, okay, we've got 2 years and then we're going to lose the whole shebang off to a VR46 team as they come up. So Yamaha clearly are having issues with their own factory bike right now, so maybe they won't run a satellite team as they sort of focus back in on their factory machines to get them back competitive.
I think that's a really good point and probably the most logical way to go. We see with MotoGP teams sometimes logic isn't the first thing they gravitate towards, but yeah, all good points. I think I heard a rumor that the the Aventia or Aspar teams, I forget which one at this point, we're talking to Yamaha at this point about it, but
yeah, I think it's more likely Aventia from what I heard.
Yeah. So yeah. We'll see. But yeah, big breaking news. Another thing, if we keep on the topic of Tech 3, they finally did confirm Hafi Syrin as their MotoGP rider for 2018, which is great news for the sport. He seems to be one of the nicest guys in the paddock. The first Malaysian, which is absolutely huge for the sport to be on a MotoGP full-time ride. Because again, that market in Southeast Asia is the absolute biggest for motorcycles and MotoGP right now.
And I think he had a really impression sharing, too, at the last testing. I mean, that was his first time on a MotoGP bike, and he had to do that in front of the cameras and in front of quite an audience. A lot of people normally get like a sneaky test, maybe at Valencia at the end of the season or, somewhere where, no one's really focusing on this. But, I thought he did really well. And, I assume, too, when they first jumps on it, all the safety aids are dialed up to 10, but he was turning in some, pretty respectable lap times toward the end there, I thought. So he's certainly got comfortable and certainly got to grips, I think, quite quickly with that MotoGP bike. It was great to see.
For sure. Yeah, he definitely made the most of his opportunity, which I think he had the seat unless something horribly went wrong, which it clearly didn't. So definitely really nice to see.
Now, another piece of news, this is more for our listeners in the UK. BT Sport have announced they will continue to broadcast live MotoGP television coverage in the UK, at least until the end of 2021. I haven't seen their coverage, but most people seem to think, I think the coverage is pretty detailed, it's pretty good. I know Michael Laverty has joined the commentary team this year as well. So I always, great to see knowledgeable people like ex-riders current BSB riders, but an ex-MotoGP rider getting in there, really adding some detailed and some real technical knowledge to the commentary as well. So that'll be great to see.
Yeah, again, being here in the States, I haven't seen full BT Sport coverage, but it sounds like they show every session. They have a great lineup. I think they do have a podcast, which if you haven't listened to that, it's basically their after show, which they just export the audio out for you. But I've listened to that a handful of times, and it's always really detailed coverage on what's going on. I saw Julian Ryder, kind of taken to some Twitter trolls during this last week about the BT Sport coverage. But I mean, it sounds like for what it is, it's a really detailed team. So for our UK listeners, it's definitely good news.
Yeah, and equally too, you're right. The after the show is really good because typically that's featured Colin Edwards as well, and he has a pretty comical and sort of slightly unique inside view to what's gone on over the weekend. One of the other news items too was Francesco Bagnaia has now been signed up for a 2-year deal directly with Ducati and will be placed at the Satellite Pramac team for the 2019 and 2020 seasons. That's good to see a good, strong Moto2 rider who I'm hoping is going to have a good, strong season this year as well, but already to have his route into MotoGP signed, I think that will make him happy.
Yeah, I think the silly season is definitely quite silly. I don't know where the precedent is for signing a Moto2 rider before their season has even gotten underway, but that, you know, Pramac seat is a hot seat. So ever since Bagnaia has had a run on it, that first time, you know, after his Moto3 season, I believe he had a bet with the Aspar team, and he was able to get a couple of laps in. You know, after Ducati saw that, you know, all the teams have been chomping at the bit for him, and with the impressive showing last year in Moto2, you know, it makes sense. I'm quite surprised in a way. In another way, I'm not surprised whatsoever. But yeah, it's going to be nice to see him on that bike, and hopefully he can have a good Moto2 season.
And I'm sure he's happy and smiling to be able to jump on a Ducati. You know, if you're coming up for Moto2, I think, you know, Ducati is a proven bike. We've seen how Rabat and Miller, having changed from Honda to Ducati Satellite bikes this year, have already had a step up in performance. So I think, you know, it sounds like that's a very friendly, if I can say that, MotoGP bike to land on to sort of do your first rookie year in.
Definitely. And, you know, he has the... You know, it's Ducati, it's Italian, he's flying the flag for the manufacturer. You know, we saw this with Iannone right out of Moto2, and, you know, basically it seems like they're going to be grooming him for the factory team. And we'll see how Jack does this year. Jack has had two really impressive tests so far. Obviously, it's just testing, and, you know, Jack has had a bit of a problem in the past with staying on the bike during the race. So we'll see. But, you know, Ducati have set themselves up well, you know, they have two great factory riders, but for whatever reason, if contract negotiations don't go the way Ducati and the riders seem to be hoping, they're definitely ready for the future.
Yeah, it's good to see. So we had World Superbikes at Phillip Island this weekend. There was some rain, unfortunately, hanging around the track, and there was a little bit of rain during some of the free practice sessions on the Friday. But come Saturday, when they were running the qualifying Superpole 1 and Superpole 2, I think although there had been some rain early in the day, it was pretty dry, but it was cold and windy, wasn't it?
Yeah, it seemed to be very windy, and that's what was causing the main issue to a lot of the riders. You know, we all know in Phillip Island, weather conditions can be really tricky just because it's right sitting on the ocean. But yeah, the wind seemed to be the main issue for a lot of the riders.
Yeah, and I think that sort of persisted through the weekend. There was a little bit of news actually just announced. I don't know if you saw this too, the fact that World Superbike has introduced this notion of independent teams and independent riders for 2018.
Yeah, you know, I have in... I know Dornas are probably trying to push what they're doing in MotoGP as well, but every time the commentators try to give us a breakdown of independent team, reference team, factory team, I have to admit I was quite confused on how they have that laid out.
I agree. It was really confusing. I mean, so they'll take the factory teams, for example, like if you've got the Ducati factory team. Okay, so that's the factory team. That's the reference team. And therefore, other runners will be the reference team. Well, and so that's fairly straightforward. That's fairly clear. Same with Kawasaki. But it seems, for example, if you're Loris Baz running the BMW, the only BMW, you're seen as the reference team. Which in my mind makes no sense.
Agreed. Yeah, they definitely... Dorna are trying in World Superbikes. They're trying in a lot of areas. I think the main thing is to get credit for the smaller teams so they can get into Parc Fermé, whether it be for qualifying and the races. But yeah, you know, it's... I think the notion of it is good, but they definitely need to figure out what their explanations. You know, it took us a while to figure out the reverse grid last year. I think we got that. We understand how that works. I think this is just another one of those things where the more they reference it, I think the clearer it may become for the viewers as well. So,
And it was easier to see. If you had access to the live timing screens, then each of the entrants is color-coded to tell you whether it's a reference team or an independent, but that didn't come up with the TV feed. So I agree, it is a little confusing. It's something I think they'll need to address as they go on to see how they can get this across. But like you say, the top independent rider will be in Parc Fermé at the end, but they won't necessarily go up onto the podium unless they've been placed in the top three. And the other part of it too is Pirelli apparently are offering prize money to the best independent rider of each World Superbike race, which was great. But I do remember, and I've had this like from previous years watching World Superbike, and again a little bit here, I sometimes think, well, a favor you could do for these sort of mid-pack runners is just to feature their riders during the race. Often these guys are having good sort of mid-pack scraps. You can see on the timing screens, you know. But, you know, we have this habit of always just following the leaders round or, you know, sort of the big brand names. So trying to give these mid-teams some good TV exposure, I think would be helpful to them as part of this, trying to improve, you know, the recognition of independent riders and independent teams.
Definitely. And I think we, you know, they, with some of the races we have, which we'll get into discussing a little bit more, I think they actually did a pretty good job of it. This go around, there were a couple battles, you know, for 10th, 11th position, or 10th through 7th, mm-hmm. I think. And I think they had a pretty good coverage, you know, even if it was for maybe only a lap, it's still, mm-hmm. they focused on some riders. So that was nice. Obviously, being an American, I'm always kind of on the lookout for where Gagne, where PJ Jacobson are, which right now is towards the back of the grid. But, you know, they got some airtime, so it was definitely nice to see, so.
Yeah, unfortunately, PJ, I think he's got a hard task ahead of him. I mean, it's a new bike. I mean, also having to get to grips with Phillip Island, which I don't think is a track he would have ridden before. And then on top of that, too, if I remember, he's having to be the lead development rider for Honda's move to the Magneti Marelli electronics.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing.
The factory team is still on the Cosworth system. So, yeah, he's got a lot on his plate right now. And it was unfortunate because he did end up down in 12th place in the Super Pole 1. But Gagne himself actually was a little unlucky not to have gone through into Super Pole 2. I think he went down, if I remember, in one of the free practices, and just on at that time, what was a best lap?
Yeah, he was really close to going straight in, but when we got to Q2, you know, Q1, he had a pretty good performance, but he just missed out. It started 13th on the grid, 0.2 behind Toprak and Jordi Torres, who were able to get those fastest laps in Q1 and proceed on to Q2.
Yeah, and it was pretty impressive because like Gagne was down in 9th near the end and was just able to put in that good lap time just before the session finished, like you say, to finish 3rd. So for Q Super Pole 1, we had, like you say, Torres and Toprak here, the two going through. Gagne, Loris Baz was there in 4th, Roman Razos, Maxwell Mercado, Yoni Hernandez down in 8th, and then Herflos, Jezek, Falzon, and PJ was down in 12th.
I do have to say before we move on to Super Pole 2, that Yoni Hernandez was, you know, I don't know if it was just the lack of TV coverage on him. I completely forgot he was even there during the weekend, which is pretty unfortunate because he had some competitive rides in MotoGP, but we saw him last year in Moto2 struggle. And yeah, it was definitely disappointing on that front.
Well, it is considering, you know, he's on a Kawasaki, and in theory, at this point now, every Kawasaki in theory should be an exact duplicate of what the KRT racing team is racing.
Exactly.
You know, Toprak, again, he would have done the European Superstock 1000, so he wouldn't have raced, I assume, at Phillip Island.
No, I think both Toprak and PJ would have, as they did Super Sport.
So they
would have had track time there.
But, right, okay. So this looked familiar. But Toprak, you know, that he finished in 2nd there. And like you say, Yoni Hernandez is back in 8th there, you know.
For sure. And I think that just comes down to the level of the team, you know, being able to set that bike up. I think Hernandez has shown himself as a good rider if he has a competitive package, but it's finding that and, you know, having the financial package together as well and the people around them to put together a good bike for him, which seems to be struggling with. So Just thought I'd note that out pretty quickly, but yeah, we can go on to Super Bowl II now.
Well, and I was just going to say too as well, you know, Phillip Island is a slightly different, unique track compared to some of the other ones coming up as well. So I think we may well see some different teams and different riders shining at the upcoming next couple of rounds.
That's very true.
But yeah, Super Bowl II, still dry, but still very, very windy. Unfortunately, I think Salvatore, for the Aprilia rider, who had been going really, really well through a lot of the free practice sessions and was up there sort of top two, top three for the times, including with his time mate Laverty, was an early crash. I think he went down at Siberia. That brought out the red flag, and it turned out, unfortunately, that he had to be medevaced away with a fractured collarbone. I saw some pictures of him recovering from surgery. So best wishes to Salvatore. Hope for a quick recovery. I think it's 3 weeks now until the next round.
Yep.
I don't know if that's enough time, but it'd be great to see him back, because like, both of the Aprilias were doing well over this weekend.
Yeah, it was definitely good to see the Aprilias, you know, make a good step. I think Salvadori will be ready for Thailand, you know, with, you know, just a collarbone. For the racers, you know, they see that, you know, they're ready to get back 2-3 weeks tops.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all remember the amazing Jorge Lorenzo incident, which is definitely the exception to the rule. But even with that said, you know, I think with, you know, 3-4 weeks to get ready, he'll be back.
Yeah, that would be great to see. But after the red flag and the restart, there was actually a small spate of crashes. Cameo went down. I think he was really, really pushing for a time right from the get-go. And when he went down at turn four, having lost the front, but he ultimately trashed the bike, so he wasn't able to set a time. And then Jordi Torres went down and turn 10. Again, he wasn't able to set a time. And then literally straight afterwards, Alex Lowes was down as well with a low side. He was able to get it going and got the bike back to the pits. So I remember with about 4 minutes to go, we had Laverty topping the timesheets, Davis, Sykes, and Melandri was there in fourth. He's had been showing really, really good compared to his teammate Chaz, and Vandermark in fifth, and Lowe's then in sixth. And still with only 4 minutes to go, Ray at that point hadn't even been out. He hadn't even set a time.
Yeah, I did see that when there was the red flag, you saw him run right back into the box. You know, I don't know if it was a setting on the bike, if there was a mechanical issue, but yeah, he didn't go out until, you know, with about 4 minutes left. But yeah, it was, they still hadn't explained that. So not sure what happened in that qualifying session, but, they were definitely leaving it to the wire there.
Yeah. And then just in that last couple of minutes, then, you know, he had everybody out pushing for that last chance, just trying to get in that last final flying lap. And that ended up then with Sykes taking first, Laverty in second, Melandri with a pretty strong third, Alex Lowes in fourth, Chaz Davis in fifth, Johnny Ray, who just did one flying lap and then just came straight back in again, he ended up sixth. He just didn't really look comfortable, I think, through any of the free practice sessions, and certainly not in qualifying. I don't know if it was the wind that was causing him issues at that point, but he didn't look his normal sort of comfortable self.
For sure, yeah. He didn't look comfortable on the bike. I have to say, throughout the images that they showed during testing earlier in the week, Chaz seemed to have real issues with the bike. So yeah, I don't know if it was a mechanical thing, if it were tires, if it was just the weather, what was going on. But it seems like with the amount of crashes, definitely a tricky session during Super Bowl. But yeah.
And then we had Chavi Forrest in seventh, Michael Vandermark in eighth, Toprak in ninth, and then essentially the crashes, Salvatore, Cameo, and Jordi Torres in 12th. Now, talking about tires, one thing I picked up on is that Pirelli had bought a newer profile, I think it was a rear tire, for people to use, if I remember. It had a taller profile, I think they were describing it at, with the idea that it would somehow spread and manage the heat through the carcass better, because they knew that the track's abrasive, and they were concerned that the tires might start overheating. And I know, I think Melandri was one of the people running that taller profile rear tire.
He was, yeah. You know, I don't know you know, how it was explained, at least to the TV coverage, is that it was a different profile, in that they were trying to, you know, disperse the heat throughout the tire a little bit more. I'm not quite sure how having a taller profile would really allow for that. I would assume there need to be some sort of construction in the carcass to allow for that heat to be displaced. But yeah, it looks like Melandri, you know, however that tire was set up and designed, he definitely got along with that tire and was, again, with Sykes, was looking very comfortable, really being able to push that bike. Though Melandri, through the entire weekend on the straight, you saw the bike weaving all over the place just because of his size, and he's not able to get the weight back on the rear tire, but it
you
seems
think
terrifying.
What was that? Yeah, because he seemed to be the only person. I didn't see any of the other Ducatis having that problem, but he would, like, flat out down the straight doing, I don't know, 300 kilometers an hour. This thing is wriggling and wobbling and bucking and weaving, and he's just, like, full on the gas. And
it looked terrifying. It was literally every time he went down the straight, it was like that. So definitely props to him. And, you know, he knew the limit of the bike. He knew what was going on. But, he definitely felt good on the bike, on those tires, and that brought us to race one.
Mm-hmm. So race one, again, was just a continuation of the same conditions we had. It was about sort of 20 degrees. It was pretty cloudy. There was some rain threatening, I think, but we had dry conditions, but still that very, very pervasive, very, very strong wind. And, you know, we know that Phillip Island is an abrasive track, and, you know, some were saying with the cooler temperatures, that sort of makes it even worse, in fact. So there was definitely the sense that with 22 laps distance for the race, that it was going to be a slow race to start. A lot of people having to sort of manage their tires, managing the performance, and then it sounded like there was going to be, you know, for that last sort of, eight laps or so, that's when the gloves would come off, and, you know, we'd start to see who's still got some pace left to run to the finish.
For sure. And that's really the classic Phillip Island race and what we're kind of all used to. But that is not what we saw whatsoever. From the off, we saw Sykes, Melandri, really fight at the front. And we saw Tom Sykes do a classic Tom Sykes and just try to break the field. I like to refer to it as a Tom Sykes and Jorge Lorenzo, where they go off and really just dictate the pace and have everyone try to catch them. So we've seen that not work out very well for Tom Sykes in the recent past, at least. So, you know, I was pretty hesitant to see him go off. But a lot of the riders, you know, maintain that really hot pace, a lot hotter than what the riders were expecting. And definitely made for a different Phillip Island race.
Yeah, Sykes, like you say, he just pushes to the front. But sometimes I think with him, that seems to suit his style. I've always got the impression with Sykes, he struggles with passes. He struggles if he gets, you know, bogged down to try and get past people. He's not, you know, either as aggressive, or he's just not quite the master of pulling out the passes.
Definitely, yeah.
Ray got a fantastic start. I mean, he moved from sixth up into second within two corners. But I think, you know, that was Sykes' mission. His game plan was to convert that pole position into just get out front and just pull a gap and then just try and nurse it as best he can.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point there. If you look back on really any of the reshuffles last year, the race two starts, Sykes always had a really difficult time making his way through the field, whereas Ray did exactly what he did in this race. He just shoots from whatever starting position he's in all the way to the front within a matter of two or three corners. We see the same thing anytime Marquez starts back there on a grid in the MotoGP race. Same thing with Lorenzo. If they're in the back, they like to shoot forward. So I think that, you know, it being Sykes' style, it certainly is. But I think what he's really struggled with recently is making that tire last. And that's what my immediate concern was to see if he's going to be able to make this last. So
the other sad thing was watching Laverty unfortunately drop back from his second place on the grid. He wasn't really able to capitalize that and just seemed to sort of gently go back until he settled into around about sixth. Melandri was up there, though, pretty close, hassling Ray. And I think this is where, from my standpoint, I thought we started to see how this rev capping had come into play. You know, for me, I really noticed it on the main straight. Well, we know it's pretty windy there, but Melandri was pretty much able to stay with Ray in pretty tight and pretty pretty close, such they were dicing on the brakes into turn one. The Kawasaki for me on those long straights always last year had seemed to have a little bit more, you know, those revs gave it a little slight extra legs. He was able to pull a bit of a distance and therefore he wouldn't be threatened under the brakes. But it was clear, you know, from the first one or two laps that I thought, you know, Melandri's can compete with Ray here. Now it's just, you know, who can get into that turn one. It seemed to be a fairly key who can get in there first.
Yeah, it seemed like the Ducati's drive out of that final corner was a lot better. It became really apparent because, like we were just discussing before, Melandri down that straight, the bike is going every which way, which cannot help the overall stability and top speed, though he is very light. But, you know, last year the Kawasaki's, they blitzed everyone. So for that to happen on a continual basis throughout that race, we definitely saw those rev limits come into play there.
So early on, it seemed to me, like I say, Sykes sort of going out first. I think Melandri was able to squeeze his way past Johnny Ray and set off after Sykes. Ray just seemed to just try and follow Melandri to help him pull him up to Sykes. Javi Forres at that point had got himself into fourth, which I thought was pretty impressive because he's ahead of Chaz at that point on the other factory bike. I think we had the Yamahas at that point pretty much together in seventh and eighth with Vandermark, if I remember, was slowly moving forwards too, sort of just place by place.
Yeah, you know, I was really impressed about the battle with Javi Forres and Chaz. That's where you can really see, like, not that there is a rule this year that all the teams need to be able to purchase what the factory has for a set price. Ducati was basically giving Forres the you know, factory spec bike before, but to really see that, you know, see him battling with Chaz was really impressive and not something I was expecting. It seemed like Chaz was struggling, so that for him to come through in the race was really impressive like that. But then Forres seemed to just come out of nowhere, but I can't say it's a big surprise because we really saw him push for the podium a lot last year as well. Again, it's just about staying on the bike for him.
Yeah, no, it was good because like the Yamahas, I thought, were having a really good scrap. Vandermark, kind of like from halfway, sort of two-thirds distance, clear, I think, you know, he'd either just use up his tires because he just seemed to lose a ton of pace and just started drifting backwards. One of the points actually I just wanted to mention there is you were talking about Yoni Hernandez being fairly ignored or unknown. He did go out fairly early in that race, and there was just a caption that came up saying like, oh, you know, Hernandez has crashed, but no real more explanation or commentary from that point. But as we got to the end of the race, we began to realize that that was actually an important point. But Vandermark definitely would seem to be having issues with his tires there, and that allowed, I think, Chaz to catch up and pass the Yamahas and then start going after Forres as well. And then I think he got up to Forres and was able to pass Forres. But, you know, with two laps to go, you know, we had Johnny Ray, who looked fairly competitive and fairly in there behind Melandri. But, you know, within a lap, he started to lose chunks and chunks of time. And I think it was a few times where you saw him coming around left-handers, taking a really long look at the... Initially, I thought he was looking behind him, but it wasn't. He was actually looking down at his rear tire. So, you know, clearly big tire issues on the left-hand side for him.
Yeah, you know, initially once Melandri passed him with three or four laps to go, you saw Ray take a huge look behind him. You saw him continually looking, you know, for a couple corners, you know, behind him and then again at the tire. And Melandri just eked away from him. And, you know, there was this sense of, okay, he's just going to manage it. He's just going to kind of nurse it home. But he'll be good. There's a huge gap to third place, but that wasn't the case. He really struggled bringing that home. Additionally, with his physical condition, it seemed like he had a bit of the flu that was going around his family earlier that week. So
yeah,
that certainly didn't help with it, but I think he understood that this was a big mechanical issue with the tires.
And with the last few laps as well, Melandri was able to take the lead and ease away from Sykes. So at the finish line, it was Melandri. And I was just trying to remember, isn't there like that fantastic shot of him doing that one-handed power slide? 2006, I can't remember, MotoGP. you know, he's just coming out that corner, one-handed power slide. It's pretty amazing. Just smoking up the back wheel. So he's now had wins in 250 MotoGP and now Superbike. So he crossed the line in first. Tom Sykes in second. Chaz Davis took the third spot with Javi Forrest, just literally a split second behind him. Johnny Ray hung on to fifth because Alex Lowes and Kamiya were closing in sixth and seventh. And Kamiya had a pretty impressive showing. Initially, he looked to be out of that, but he was able to somehow maintain the tires and pull back to finish a strong seventh there for the Honda.
Yeah, it was nice to see him up there in seventh. You know, we saw Gagne in 12th. So the Hondas, you know, kind of with race one on par where we saw them. Again, it's Phillip Island, so you know the racing here is generally a little bit different. So it's hard to read into that too much. And like you said, they're right now that factory team is on the Cosworth Electronics, and PJ's putting a lot of the donkey work into. To get that sorted. But, you know, seventh, with all those factors kind of keep, you know, taken into account is big. And I think there's a lot of potential with the Honda to go.
Yeah, for sure. I was looking last year. Hayden finished race one 11th, retired in the second race, and Bradle finished both races in 15th. Mm. So that was sort of a benchmark of how Honda were doing last year. So, yeah, they've definitely made some improvements there. So Laverty, unfortunately, had slipped back to eighth with Vandermark, again, through tire problems, finishing in ninth. Mercado in 10th. Baz in 11th, which I thought was pretty impressive because there's been some hints with Baz. He's still saying that, you know, he's pretty much running the stock road bike or the race version of the road bike electronics on that bike. So, you know, he's still got some development work with that, I think, once he starts getting the parts.
For sure.
Gagne, Jake finished in 12th, which I think was, again, a good showing for him, with Toprak in 13th.
Yep. And yeah, I think the battle between Toprak, Gagne, and Baz is nice to watch. You know, they showed it for a little bit. But yeah, overall, really impressive, you know, we saw to round out the rest of the grid, we had Ramos, Zizek, and PJ Jacobson in 16th, and we had retirements from Torres, Hernandez, Falzon, and Maxwell as well. So that was race one. Not the race we really expected. One from Phillip Island, two from World Superbike. We had another race the next day.
Yeah, and it was interesting then that after the race finished, we were able to go back and certain information started to come out that, in actual fact, Yoni Hernandez, he didn't just crash. His whole rear tire exploded. And on the Twitter, there was a couple of images there of just caught by one of the photographers. And you see the whole thing completely, the whole tire is completely let go. So this started... also with having had tire issues and slip back, and some of the other riders really complaining about how the left-hand side of that tire had coped with that race, this sort of set up the format that for race two on the Sunday, they decided to have a mandatory tire swap. So essentially a flag-to-flag race, 22 laps, but there'd be a window between laps 10, 11, and 12 where it was mandatory to come in for a tire change.
Yeah, and you know, Andrew, in all honesty, I didn't realize that Yoni Hernandez had such a bad issue. So I'm actually looking at Twitter right now and looking at the photos that are on his Twitter feed, and this is you can see the tire just completely pop. He's, you know, being flicked off the bike. You know, I originally just thought it was kind of down to Ray and Vandermark and kind of a safety issue and kind of an influence that Ray has with being three-time world champion. But yeah, that tire just completely exploded. That's pretty crazy.
Well, and it seems Pirelli were conscious that they, you know, may have issues here with their tires. They issued a formal notice to teams to say that they're going to implement a pressure control procedure a few minutes prior to the start, with the idea that they select a few riders at random, and that they've handed out these standardized tire pressure gauges. And they'd already told all the teams that on the grids, the minimum tire pressures were 1.6 bar as recommended by Pirelli. So essentially they were saying that, you know, we don't, obviously our advice is do not run this. It didn't seem that it was mandated, but they were basically saying we don't want the tires run at a lower pressure than this. But it was interesting when they actually did go through this process, after the 9 riders they randomly checked in the 3 races at the weekend, 4 were below the minimum 1.6 bar. So clearly some teams knowingly choosing to run these tires at below recommended pressures.
Even still, it's really hard for me to fathom and understand how Pirelli had such a large issue like this. You know, mm-hmm. really the only precedent we have is the Bridgestone tires in 2013.
Yep.
And that was a very, very different set of circumstances. The track had just been resurfaced. There was absolutely no testing time on it. So for that to happen and for pit stops to be needed, as crazy as it was, it made sense. But Pirelli's been here for the last how many years? They've been running superbikes here since the early 2000s. And they have an incredible amount of information. It's not like the regulations have changed in a way where they're producing more power or putting more pressure or drive on the rear tire. It seems to me unacceptable that an issue like this happens for the tire manufacturer who has all this data, all this information to create a tire that this shouldn't happen with.
I think it was one thing, you know, if you're going around, and there was, you know, as they were trying to figure out what are they going to do for race 2, it sounds like they were going around talking to teams and riders and stuff and soliciting opinions. And, you know, certainly some of the feedback was like, oh, well, you know, it's up to riders to manage their tires and just sort of like ride accordingly and things. And I think if it was a case of, you know, riders finishing with chewed up left sides or something, that's one thing. But, you know, when you have a tire letting go explosively like this, and I'm sure this is why Johnny slowed up. I mean, if I remember last year, 2017 at Donington through Craner Curves, mm-hmm. he had a Pirelli rear tire let go on him explosively as well. And I think my sense is probably when he started sensing issues and looking down, I don't know if he could see anything from where he was sitting, but I bet he had that replaying through his mind. And I think this is the issue. You know, when you've got tires like physically letting go, then I think, yeah, you know, this the tire people haven't sort of done their math quite right. And clearly afterwards they're saying, okay, well, yeah, for 2019 we'll bring a harder compound. But there was that kind of sense, at least from my standpoint, thinking like, well, shouldn't you have bought that this year?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, whatever the case may be, you know, it ultimately ended up with a mandatory pit stop, either, you know, starting at lap 10, 11, or 13. You could come in and change the tires. If you didn't come in by lap 13, you'd be black flagged. Yeah. So that's ultimately what Pirelli, what Dorna, what the teams came up with as a solution to this tire issue, which ended up, you know, making for a very, very interesting race too. You know,
and we should say at this point, just as a spoiler alert, if you haven't seen race 2 yet of the World Superbikes, pause the podcast, please do yourself a favor and go watch it, go enjoy it, and then maybe come back. From this point on, you know, if we ruin your enjoyment of it, well, you've been warned. It was generally something good. But to say that, to set up a good race, we had to have essentially a race now divided into two sprints. Like you say, we have this three-lap window where they need to come in, and they've got a minimum time in the pit, 63 seconds they have to be in, with the idea being is to not rush them too much. The other thing, too, is don't forget we've still got the reverse grid. So this is what World Superbikes needed to do to give us a good World Superbike race. We needed rev caps. We needed concessionary parts. We needed reverse grid. We needed dodgy tires with a flag-to-flag compulsory tire change. Yes, and a track like Phillip Island.
Well, I think we got the formula now. I think we can probably sell that to Dorna and make our own racing series then, yeah?
So the starting grid, and I always struggle until they actually write it down. I can never figure out what it's going to be. But it was Harry Forrest in pole with Johnny Ray second on the front row, Alex Lowes. And then second row was Liam Cammier, Laverty, Vandermark. Third row was Chaz, Tom Sykes in eighth, and Melandri in ninth, his punishment from having won. Top Rack started in 10th, Jordi Torres in 11th, 12th was Jake Gagne, and 13th was Baz, and everybody else behind him. But those are the main ones.
For sure. So, you know, we raced two, started off, and it was much more of a classic Phillip Island race, as we're used to, as opposed to race one, where we saw, you know, Sykes, you know, jump off into the lead. Everyone was right together from the start. Basically, a classic Moto 3 encounter with a lot more power. So that's what we got to enjoy. You know, there was what, maybe over the first, you know, three or four laps, there was a group of seven or eight riders in front.
Well, it did. I mean, the action started right from the beginning. I mean, clearly with two sprints, the riders were definitely going to go full out right to the tire change window. So Ray jumped straight into the lead. Laverty got a great start from fourth and into turn four, and then very quickly took the lead. And then he just went like a stab rat. He just pulled a gap in that first lap of almost a second. It was an incredible pace. Unfortunately, it didn't last because he went down, I think, in lap three. And at that point, in the early on, you almost had like Ray actually holding up a whole procession of riders as Kamiya slipped through on him. And then there was a whole great scrap, wasn't there, of sort of Davis, Ray, Harry Forrest was there, Vandermark as well. I think even Chaz was up there in the lead at one point, and then he went wide and turned four, and Ray comes through. I mean, you literally had like the top 10 bikes at that point sort of all in a line. And it was kind of difficult to know because, you know, literally each corner the lead could change.
Yeah, it was a fantastic, you know, series of laps, you know, classic Phillip Island overtakes on the Honda hairpin, Lukey Heights. It was super exciting, and forgive me that I forgot Laverty had such an explosive start, because, you know, he had that kind of bizarre crash. I haven't seen any replay footage of it other than really the onboard that was shown at the time. But it seemed to be in a kind of an odd place that he went down.
Yeah, and again, the comments from the press release from Aprilia team, they make some odd comment, and they said, oh, you know, he was doing really, really well until the rear tire let go. You know, so there wasn't the suggestion of like, oh, you know, it was just a mistake on my part, or the tire's a bit too cold, I went in a bit too quick. There's this sort of direct reference to the rear tire let go as if somehow, again, they'd either got a faulty tire or there was some sort of issue with that. They didn't seem to elaborate, and I've not heard or seen anything more expansive about that. But it was just an interesting turn of phrase, you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. They're definitely press officers doing their job.
Going back to your other point too, I don't know if you noticed, like, so Tom Sykes started in eighth, but he wasn't really making an impression in that sort of opening session.
Yeah.
I didn't really see him coming forwards. I remember like Top Rack at one point, you know, was up in eighth as well. So Sykes just not having much pace. And it was again, this is another instance of where I could see that Johnny Ray just wasn't able to defend on the main straight. I mean, for sure, you've got a slipstream that happens. And I think the Kawasaki's are a little bit wider than, say, the Ducati's. So maybe, you know, the Ducati slipstream behind the Kawasaki's have a little bit. But yeah, again, you know, Sykes and Ray, both of them just didn't seem to have that top end power that we've often seen them have previous years. So they're really having to fight it out, and Ray was having to get pretty brave into turn one to stay ahead.
For sure. So yeah, so basically had at the time of lap 10, where we came back into the pit stops, it was a group of four or five riders. It was, you know, Ray, Forrest, Lowe's, we had Chaz up there, and, you know, lap 10 came around, everyone went around, and was it Ray, Forrest, and Lowe's all came in at the same time? And then
it was
Chaz
Vandermark,
Okay, yeah. It was Vandermark, and basically Chaz
Forrest,
was out
Ray
front.
And Vandermark came in. Laverty came in first, but he was sort of, 15th or something at that point. He was just basically circulating at the back. But they were the first in. But just before that, too, as well, unfortunately, Jake Gagne went down at turn four.
He did. And in that case, the pit changes or tire changes really helped both Laverty and Gagne, you know,
because he was able to pick up the bike and get going again and come, you know, pretty much straight in and sort of get the bike sorted out. One of the things was instantly noticed about the tire change procedure, where they give the bike 63 seconds, is the Kawasaki's, for example, I noticed opted to take the 63 seconds sitting at the pit box. I mean, it was a bit bizarre to watch a rider sort of get off the bike and have a drink and almost have a bit of a natter.
Yeah.
You know, because you're used to the MotoGP where it's all sort of like hopping and spinning and jumping and leaping and instant in and out type of thing. So this looked oddly relaxed. But one thing I did notice is that Kawasaki, they took 63 seconds at the box and then released them. Where some of the other riders had, once the tire change was finished, they made their way out and then would stop at pit exit, waiting there for the time to tick over before them to go. So you actually had like people like Ray, I remember, having to almost thread his way through these stopped bikes to get himself back out on track, which just seemed like a really odd arrangement.
It was very odd. You know, I don't know if that's not clear within the rules and how that's laid out. I also don't understand how the riders who were released early from their pit area, did they have like a stopwatch on their dashboard letting them know how much time they had until they let go, or was it just like a guesstimate?
That's my only thought, is that somehow there's like, there's loops or timing loops or something, because they cross in and cross out of pit lane, which is maybe used for them to apply the speed limit and to make sure that people aren't violating speed limit. And that, like you say, gives them a countdown on their dash or something so they know where to go, because there's certainly not a marshal happily going, okay, now you can go.
And even if there was, they don't listen to the marshals at the end of the pit lane. So, it was very bizarre. And, Ray had a gap when he came in. And as they all left, they completely all left together. The pit lane was very bumpy. So to get out there in that case caused some safety concerns. But, again, everyone just kind of went out and is kind of a free-for-all at that point.
And then, so lap 11, that was when the next batch came in, and that was Davis, Melandri, Sykes, Cameo, I think, came in at that point, Torres and Baz. So they all came in at that second point. And then, unfortunately, early on, lap 13, Davis lost the front from the lead and goes down, and that's it. He picked up the bike, but I saw the handlebar was bent, so it's clear that he wasn't getting back on that.
Yeah, so as soon as I saw Chaz continue to go around when everyone else in his group went in, red flags went off in my head. Just immediately, because if a rider is in a group, when he comes back out on track, he's going to anticipate and want to be in that group, per se. When everyone else comes in, they're already going to... You come in, and then they have a full lap to get those tires up to temperature. So by the time Chaz is already coming back out, they have a full lap, those tires are ready, and those riders who came in are now ready to push, where Chaz has to warm that tire up. He has to get temperature in the tire. And if he's expecting to be with those riders, it's a recipe for disaster. So either he has to have an incredibly cool head and let them create a gap, knowing that he can then push once the tire's up to temperature, or what happened is going to happen. He put too much pressure on the front and it let go. So definitely it's always easier to think about it on the couch from where we are. But I think as a strategy, it's always really difficult when you're in a group, everyone comes in and then you're trying to push on cold tires.
And so that was pretty much most of the tire changes all done. But do you remember back to the MotoGP? Do you remember someone missed the window?
Yeah, Mr. Marc Marquez of sorts did miss the window to come in. He was black flagged. Unfortunately, we did have a rider black flagged as well.
Mr. Falzon thought he would somehow again. There wasn't an interview, so I don't know if they just lost count or there was some bad communication. He missed the window, so he was black flagged, so he was out. So then, with all the tire changes done, like the initial running at that point, Melandri up front, Forrest, Sykes, Lowe's, Ray back in fifth with Vandermark and Cameo following. Again, Cameo having another strong showing, and by lap 14. Ray has been able to move his way forward. So now you've got Forres, Ray, and Sykes kind of together in a group, but they're pretty closely followed at that point by Vandermark, Melandri, Lowe's, Camier. And it's certainly like Vandermark and Lowe's are really scrapping. I mean, I know they're teammates and, you know, it's the first person you need to beat, but I can imagine like Paul Denning sat on the pit wall watching those two, because some of those moves were pretty, pretty tight on each other.
Definitely. They were very tight. You know, it's what we got used to last year, though. The Yamahas were kind of in their own league, really just racing each other. So it's definitely not a fight that we're not used to seeing, but I definitely wouldn't want to be Paul Denning watching those two go at it, especially as fierce as Vandermark was. You know, he made some aggressive moves over the course of the whole race and really the whole weekend. So, yeah, to see those two dicing it out, again, entertaining for us, but would not want to be the team boss there.
So now with about five laps to go, Sykes has dropped back a bit after being passed by Melandri, and Vandermark as well is starting to come off the pace. So, but we still got quite a focused group here of Forres, Ray, Melandri in third. And then with about four laps to go, Ray, I think he just, you know, puts his head down and just goes for it, you know, hits the lead. But Forres is pretty fighty and he comes back at him pretty hard. It was cool to see. I love Phillip Island, you know, for that sort of turn one, turn two combination. There's a few different lines you can take through there, and if you brave and hold it around the outside, it just gives you that inside line for turn two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there definitely some passes through that whole section which were just incredible to watch. You know, you saw someone get it right and they just totally slammed the door shut, and there's absolutely no way anyone's coming through. Make a small mistake, run just the smallest bit wide, that door's open, and whoever's behind you just is going to come barging through. Again, Phillip Island as a track, four motorcycles, there's nothing better. There's nothing better.
So then with three laps to go now, as we're starting to hot up, Ray goes first again, and Melandri is able to slip past in a second, and he's looking pretty racy too. He's able to go with Ray, and it's cool to see him, sort of dicing with Ray into that turn one. There's a couple of times when, Melandri's kind of getting up alongside him, but you can see Ray is just oftentimes just letting the brakes off that fraction of a second later and just carrying a huge amount of pace into turn one, just to get it back again.
Yeah, it was really interesting to see how they navigated that turn one, just the two of them. I can't even think about going that fast down basically what looks like going right into the center of the ocean. But they really scrapped it out very, it was hard. It was exciting. It was a very classic Phillip Island race, but certainly not what we're used to in World Superbike. Two totally different manufacturers, you know, just dicing it out. Incredible to watch, incredible to see something, the regulations possibly working, and we'll know more in the future. But getting back to the race, just with the few laps to go, Melandri just hounding Ray, and it ultimately all came down to the battle at the line.
Well, it did. I mean, it was great to see Ray actually having a fight on his hand, really having to work. And also Melandri, you know, having found the confidence. It's always been Chaz, typically towards the end of the races, who's been sort of wrestling and tussling. But Melandri, he seemed to really have a measure of that Ducati. He really seemed to have the confidence. And it was cool, like you say, on the last lap, Ray seems to have done enough to hold him off into that first corner. And you think, okay, well, previous laps, and Melandri's going to be like really hard to get him back. And actually, Ray seemed to have like a fair gap going into the first corner. But the drive that Melandri got off of that last corner was amazing.
I have absolutely no idea. Like we've said a couple times in the show already, that bike is just shaking all over the place. But I think with the factors of the rev limits, of Melandri weighing next to nothing, and the Ducati just being able to power out of that corner, we saw Melandri take the win by a fraction, less than a tenth of a second, to ultimately come up with the double for the weekend.
It was amazing. I thought Ray had it, and because the camera is sort of a head-on shot, and then you suddenly see the pace that Melandri's got and the momentum he's got, and he's like, oh, it's at the line, it's a photo finish. So yes, it was Melandri first, Ray second, and Forres in third with a very well-deserved, you know, obviously the focus was sort of on the top two, but that was a really, really strong showing by Javi Forres there to finish in third. And he wasn't that far behind Johnny Ray either.
He wasn't. Just looking at the times here, he was 0.3 behind the leader. But yeah, to see that showing from Forez, I was not expecting that whatsoever this year. So that's really nice to see. You know, there's no extra independent bike because he's already on the podium. So that was really nice. So we had Forez in third, Sykes in fourth, Lowe's in fifth, Kamier in sixth. I think that's, again, he finished sixth and seventh this time out. I think that's very, very, very positive for the Honda. They have a lot of work to do. Hopefully the change to Magneti Marelli in the future, even though they've been working on that swap for a while. So to hear that it hasn't happened already kind of makes me nervous. But again, I think this is going to be a big learning year, a big development year for them, as we've been saying for what, the last like 2 or 3 years, unfortunately. But hopefully with Kamier, with the success he's had at MV, you know, this was a very, very positive initial showing. So hopefully we see more of that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, there were large stages there where, you know, there was a real possibility that Kamier could have even finished somewhere on the podium there. I mean, he was looking pretty consistent, pretty competitive, like the whole way. And I hope with performances like this as well, that will help him as they start to do the development, that they will really listen to his feedback and help, you know, put that into developing the bike.
For sure. Yeah. So hopefully we can see the Hondas continue to creep up. To continue rounding out the points, we had Vandermark in 7th, Torres in 8th, Baz in 9th, Toprak Razgatlioglu in 10th, Romain Rabos 11th, Leandro Mercado in 12th, Gagne in 13th, PJ Jacobsen in 14th, and says Eugene Laverty 15th. I don't know if he actually finished or did he end up retiring?
I thought he retired with 2 laps to go. I think... If I remember, yeah, he didn't. I don't know. It, obviously, they still show he officially finished 15th, but I'm pretty sure he pulled into the pits.
Yeah, so we had retirement from Laverty, Davies, Jezik, and Falzon. But yeah, that wrapped up a very exciting World Superbike debut, a 2018 racing debut for us. So yeah, very, very exciting. I was pleasantly surprised with race 2 especially.
And the other little tidbit I picked up after the fact too is that Yamaha, supposedly, they say that they've got an electronics upgrade and some help coming from Japan for the next round as well. So, you know, potentially too, they were saying like, oh yeah, you know, we got some sort of goodies in the goodie box upcoming. The other thing, it didn't happen necessarily in race 2. I don't know if you picked up on this too, but from race 1, you know, they were interviewed Tom Sykes. He seems suspiciously sort of happy, more cheery in interviews.
It is weird, right?
I don't know if this is a subtle transition that I somehow has kind of gone. I remember him being a rather sort of like grumpy chap or something. So I don't know if someone's had a quiet word in his ear and he said like, you know, you never quite know what someone's true personality is.
For sure.
But yeah, he was kind of like oddly chirpy about like, oh, you know, the usual, it's a good result. You know, it's good points on the board, blah, blah, blah and stuff. So
definitely. Yeah. He seems to be happy with the bike this year. And I think after the first year of Ray, you know, wiping the floor with him, that's when we saw him most grumpy. And I think he understands his position at that team now that he is not head honcho anymore. And I think for him I think he understands that, but is very confident with the bike now to push forward. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we might be seeing him so cheerful. It's the first race of the season. We'll see. But yeah, I agree. I saw him after the first race. He was elated and I was very confused as well. So that brings us to the end of the show. Don't forget, you can always email us listener feedback at motopod@motopodcast.com. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/motopod. Please like and subscribe for updates, as well as finding us on Twitter at @moto_pod. Follow us there for news, updates, announcements, any tidbits that Andrew has found out. He's had some good rumor updates that I was not aware of today on the show, like that Yamaha tidbit. So definitely follow us there. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @MotoDerekC. You can find Andrew on Twitter at @Andy_course. You can find Skylar and Jim, Skylar at SkylarV28 and Jim at MotoRGV. All right, guys, take care. Have a good one.
Hey, thanks, Derek. Take care. Cheers. Bye.